Bruce, WASP-based approaches are at practically every airport in the country now, adds utility everywhere you go. It also makes things safer, even if you're flying a non-explicitly WASP procedure. And you mentioned learning IFR as it's done today for the people that are in training. Why not insist on a WASP GPS now also, the same way that you're insisting on a non-vacuum attitude indicator?
If I ran this club and had, you know, executive authority to make the decisions, that's what I would include. Instead of upgrading the 530W, getting a WASP-capable receiver like the 355 that we mentioned, for the reasons you mentioned. But it seems like there's a lot of politics or resistance in this club. So in my response, I'm looking for the most immediate need, which is an electronic attitude indicator that's a safety of flight issue, and then also preparing the ground for when the club is ready, either they've gathered enough money or they've changed their minds, then to do the other upgrades that would make this a more serious IFR machine. It seems to me from the description here that they're not quite a serious IFR club at this point. Maybe with some experience with some of the newer equipment, you can convert more members to that idea.
Sure. Yeah, and nobody here actually is going for the WASP GPS. We have a split between replacing just the attitude indicator with the G5 and replacing both the attitude indicator and the old DG with an attitude indicator and HSI G5 version. So let me talk to somebody here who is going with the dual G5s. We'll throw it to you, Dave.
Yeah, it's a vacuum pump has no place in the 21st century. These things are time bombs. They're museum pieces. They don't belong in airplanes anymore. It's a miracle that we all survived all those years with vacuum pumps. They should be banished, and that would be my priority in any upgrade. First, get rid of the vacuum pumps.
Hear, hear. Yeah, I could not agree more. And I think if vacuum pumps were invented today, the FAA might not certify them. I think the other thing you have to keep in mind, this is a Johnny Cash job, right? We're doing this one piece at a time. And you never want to duplicate work. You never want to rip out a product you put in 2 years ago. And so putting money into redoing the vacuum pump here, just so you can rip it out in 2 years when you put the other G5 in, seems like false economy. Let's just bite the bullet for a couple $1,000s more, get that vacuum pump out of there. It's safety, then capability, then convenience. We're talking safety here. I want that vacuum pump gone.
Bruce, I assume you pretty much agree with the vacuum systems are evil sort of thing, but primarily because of the attitude indicator, right?
Well, yes. And again, the way this club is described, there's obviously some resistance to even spending that extra couple thousand. But if I were in this club, I would be advocating more strongly for option two for reasons just stated, getting rid of the vacuum pump. That's certainly what I did with my airplane. I'm so glad I have no mechanical gyros and no pneumatic system at all to worry about anymore.
Yeah. Kevin?
If it were just my airplane, I'm absolutely, without a doubt, going with two G5s, completely removing the vacuum pump and relegating that to history. I'm not going to mess around with the GNC 355 or any of the GNCs because I would much rather have the capability of a GTN as a primary navigator. I might consider a GNC as a number two navcom, but I'd go with a GTN as a primary for sure. And also, I'd want to have a real ADS-B solution, something like a GTX 345, that will have the in and out and be a reliable option. The issue that we have here is this is a club airplane, and in a club, you have different opinions on how much people want to spend and what their level of interest is in these things. So the reason I like doing just the G5 is it leaves a little bit of money in the bank, and that, as an emotional thing, can set you up for more likely to be able to get better avionics the next time you get in there.
And what's the upsell on the GTN versus the GNC? There's a price difference there. The GNCs have been pretty popular.
They are, but you don't have any VHF navigation on that GNC that you're talking about, which is, for me, a problem. Certainly as a problem as a primary. So I'd much rather have the GTN. Separate from that, you also have the other opportunities of, if you're appropriately equipped the airplane later on down the road with the fancy technology to be able to, in the event of an engine failure, put you on a runway if you're within gliding distance, and there's a whole host of other capabilities that you get with a GTN if you want to step up and spend the extra money on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, VNAV, bigger screen, to name a few. Yeah, Catherine.
Yeah, the reason I asked for two with a bunch of dollar signs after it is I think these whoever's making this decision needs to go back to the club and do a better sell job. Clearly, they did not listen to these two pilots who did a no gyro approach in IMC. Clearly, they did not tell their story convincingly enough. This plane needs to be updated. Absolutely lose the vacuum system. Another thing I'll point out as part of that sell job is, as Bruce pointed out in his response, if you take out all the wiring that's in there, when I had my Bonanza redone, I made sure that every single wire came out and every single wire in that airplane is new. That airplane was 80 pounds lighter when it came out of the shop than when it went in. And that's something that you could sell toward these pilots that are as well. It's going to have more useful load. I'm down on putting old avionics in an airplane. I think you could potentially take out a loan even. I think just maximize what you're going to do every time the airplane goes into a shop. Because when it goes into a shop and it gets taken apart and get put back together again, that's just money right there. So I think just go for maximizing the newer conveniences. And to your point, the GTN series with the ground-based approaches is good. It's what I would do as well. And if you look at the people in the club, Mateo and Kim, they want to get their IFR rating. I could sell them on this. Edward, no longer IFR, but takes long VFR trips. Seriously, Edward needs to get IFR current again and use that. And, you know, the thing is, you could also raise the price for the memberships that you are going to extend to other people, because it's going to be a more attractive platform so for people to get into the club. So I'm all for selling these people on doing as much as possible this time in the shop.
Yeah, and if you don't know what Catherine's talking about, the people that she's referring to are in the resources. The club members are in the resources along with their choices and a little quote about why they want what they want. John.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right. You got to look at this like a business proposition, and an investment of a couple thousand dollars over the quote unquote budget could easily pay back. You could attract new members. You could get some more active members. I think if you want to be thoughtful as a steward of the club's resources, which I agree with Kevin, you don't want to just go blow the budget. That to me is an argument for when you get there doing the GNC over the GTN. I love the GTN, amazing product, but it's almost double, I think, in most cases. And I've sort of recently converted on this, that I always thought I needed to have VHF, and what if I've got to do an ILS? And I started flying a 182 with a GPS 175, which is very similar to this GNC, just minus the radio. Haven't missed it. I can't tell you the last time I did an ILS for real. And you've still got, it looks like an old, old, you know, Piper something, Navcom radio here. I wouldn't spend the money on a GTN just to get the VHF in there. Maybe you want to do a GNC and leave your old Navcoms. And then if you get down the road 5 years, maybe that GNC becomes number two and you put a GTN up top. But it's another argument in favor of doing this in phases, being very intentional about taking one step at a time and only adding what you absolutely have to.
Dave.
In my personal airplane, I have a GPS 175 without any radio navigational capabilities, and I don't miss radio navigation at all. It's every ILS runway has an LPV now. I've flown this airplane IFR in the system for 4 straight years and have never had a situation where I needed radio navigation. And I understand the arguments about, you know, hey, what if GPS goes away? What if you know all the horrible scenarios in which that might happen? But it's like, you know, in that situation, we're probably looking at thermonuclear war. We're not. it may be over anyway. But it's like, don't get hung up on radio navigation. You will not miss it.
Do you kind of have a VFR alternate in mind, just in case on days like that, or just an awareness of? If the GPS does go away, you know, I've got a bailout in this direction.
No, I mean, like GPS, it's like the sun rising in the east. In all these years, I've never had any problem with it. And it's I would just say that this IFR-approved navigator that lacks VHF radio navigation has not been an issue for me at all in many hundreds of hours of IFR flying.
Frank.
I'm going to disagree vigorously with that. And the reason is I live west of the Mississippi, where GPS outages are weekly occurrences. I have flown IMC into an airport with no GPS in the last year. It happens a lot west of the Mississippi. I'm assuming it doesn't happen as much east of the Mississippi, but there's so much military airspace out there, and there's so much, well, in our case in New Mexico, White Sands once a week publishes a GPS interference NOTAM. And I get to the point where I'm saying, okay. And then I was wanting to land, and sure enough, no GPS.
Do you have clouds in New Mexico?
I'm sorry?
Do you have clouds in New Mexico?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And sometimes they're a lot of vertical development, too. Yeah.
Kevin.
I think all of us in a general sense pretty much agree that for this to be a traveling airplane, we all kind of agree on the stuff that needs to go on the panel with some minor differences and minor changes that we each would do on it. But we're all doing similar things. So the limiting factor here in getting there is the people in the club. And that's something that I think is worth trying to figure out is – when you're putting together a club this way, how do you figure out getting a group of people together to fly an airplane that have similar missions? And I think it's when you have these different missions where these people are doing very different things with the airplane, then it becomes a lot more of a challenge. So I think there's a lot of value in trying to get people with similar thought process and similar missions to be in the same airplane together.
Catherine.
Yeah, I was just going to echo what Frank said earlier is that I'm just a suspenders and a belt kind of gal, and I'd feel pretty naked if I just had a belt on. And, you know, I suppose if there's thermonuclear war, then it doesn't matter anyway. But yeah, GPS outages are a thing, and I'd hate to be up there in the soup without some way down.
John.
Yeah, I think I agree with that, although I think there's a cheaper way to get VHF than buying a big fancy new one. That's where you throw an old KX-155 in there for the one time a year, or maybe, you know, every occasionally. I think the big point that Kevin raises is really valuable here is, and it goes back to what Catherine said earlier, you've got to, as a club leadership here, you've got to really paint a picture. This is not just a one-off financial decision. You've got to have a roadmap here of here's where we're going with this airplane. And in 5 or 8 years, if we piece by piece build this panel with dual G5s, with a navigator, with an autopilot, what can we do as a club? What kind of members could we attract? That's what's going to sell this, because as a single transaction, it's going to feel painful. But if you feel like you're building towards something, I think that's really important, because it also prevents the mistake of trying to save a buck here or there. For example, options 1 through 3, I could get behind any of them. 4 and 5 are loser options here. A 530W is a great box, but is not going to be supported for very long. That is wasted money. Putting in the autopilot you don't want because you think it saves a few bucks is a terrible waste of money. The installation on autopilot is easily the price of the actual equipment usually. So resist the temptation of those shortcuts. Paint a picture of where you're really going, save up and do it right. And if you've got to wait an extra year to get that Garmin autopilot or get the right GNC, GTN, you know, be disciplined and do that, and don't just go chasing off one-off transactions.
So the evil plan of the instrument pilots in this group is to eventually have everything and the best of everything,
absolutely,
but one thing at a time.
They want it's world domination that they're seeking.
Frank.
One option that wasn't discussed with the GPS is the current modern GPS from Garmin is a GTN XI. A lot of people with original GTNs have replaced them with GTN XIs. There is a used market of GTN navigators. And until like a year ago, they did everything the XI does. And they're very, very close right now. They do have the Smart Glide capability. And the only thing they don't have is as bright a screen. So that's a real option and a definite money saver as well.
Bruce.
This scenario reminds me a little bit of the aircraft that are in the fleet at the flight school where I instruct. We have a mix of, since we don't own the airplanes, they're all leased back. And so we've had a mix of, you know, a couple of carbureted 172s from the dark ages and pre-G1000 ones and so forth. And it's always a battle. We did a bunch of upgrades, obviously, when ADS-B became required. But it's been a battle ever since to sort of keep them up to date, the radios break or whatever. So this is a familiar situation. And as I think Kevin pointed out rightly, this isn't really so much of a technological discussion about which is the best box. This is a political thing, and it's really important. I think what John mentioned was really important. Somebody in the club, the leader, has to explain and have a plan for how this is, what's this going to look like eventually, and why are we making these decisions so that, and I also think that as club members who maybe are a little reluctant to do some of these upgrades, it was fine before, why don't we just fix what was broken? As they see the new equipment, however you choose to do the upgrades, they're going to see the advantages of that because the airplane's not going to be broken as much, you know, down for replacing, you know, parts. If they're interested in getting their instrument rating, they will see the advantages of these equipment, for, as I mentioned, for how you're going to learn how to fly IFR today instead of the way it was, you know, 30, 40 years ago. So that's my general take on how they should proceed. Dave.
I just want to, you know, put an exclamation point on what John Zimmerman said about not being penny wise and pound foolish. You know, don't waste valuable resources on obsolete equipment. When, you know, if the 530W is working, you don't have to replace it right away. You can keep using it until it breaks. But when a piece of obsolete equipment breaks, don't replace it with another piece of obsolete equipment. And keep these building blocks. You know, the thing I like about the two G5s is they're building blocks for the future. And just have that that roadmap to the future firmly in mind.
So most of you here fly behind pretty good panels. We're not talking about this Piper panel with incremental upgrades to get where you want to. And I want to talk about some of that equipment. I want to start with autopilots. And we'll go to you, Dave, because I know that your RV, which... You know, you don't have any ground-based nav radios, and you're totally fine with that. But I've heard you say before that you're not fine with not having an autopilot. And maybe that's specific to that plane, the RV. But
yeah, it's mostly specific to that airplane. But and it's true that it's like I am totally spoiled by flying with good equipment, and it's easy to be a avionics snob. But it's like you know, once you get accustomed to having a digital modern autopilot, man, it's just so hard to go back. You know, it feels like such a hardship to have no autopilot or even a old rate-based autopilot. And you don't have to get there all at once. You know, you can take incremental steps, but just be consistent and deliberate in those steps to get where you want to be. And not just squander resources on old stuff.
Yeah, and I think you've said before, if your autopilot's not working, that's a no-go for an IFR flight for you, right?
Absolutely. You know, it's just the you know, the RV4 is so light on the controls that it's like, you know, if you go heads down for, you know, half a minute, you're going to be hundreds of feet off your altitude. And I just don't have any confidence that I could fly as accurately as we're required to fly in the IFR system in IMC without an autopilot. So it's like, if it breaks in flight, I'll do my best to deal with it. And I'll let ATC know that I'm hand flying the airplane. So give me a block altitude. but it's like, you know, it was very deliberate in getting there. You know, I wanted to have an airplane that I could fly in IMC. And it didn't happen all at once. It was certainly not overnight. And it's in a lot of ways, it's similar to what this club is facing. You know, I couldn't just, you know, fire the money cannon and do it all at once. But I knew where I wanted to get with it. I knew what the mission for the airplane was going to be in the end. And so it was easier to follow that roadmap.
Yeah, that makes sense. John?
Yeah, I think modern autopilots are massively underrated by most pilots, especially for IFR. VFR, you can make a good argument. But for single pilot IFR flying, a functional, good modern autopilot is massively underrated. For older pilots, you know, you may have memories of the earlier autopilots. I certainly have some time with, you know, Cessna 300 autopilots and KFC 225s and even KAP 140s. Those weren't always great. And so I understand the skepticism there. But modern autopilots like a Garmin GFC 500 are extraordinarily good equipment. And really, it's not a convenience thing. It's a safety thing. You don't need to do it first. I don't even think you need to do it second here. But if you're really going to have a club that has some cross-country IFR people, I do not think an autopilot is a luxury item. I think that's a must-have long-term.
And to the VFR pilot in this group that does the long trips and is perfectly happy with their Piper auto control, you know?
I don't think they know what they're missing.
Okay.
You know, and so, just to the to the VFR pilots, that level button is a potential lifesaver. And you know, we all think it's not going to happen to us, but it's like the level button for a VFR-only pilot is a tremendous safety tool.
And if you can't sell the pilot on that, then you're growing the club. They can sell out.
Yeah, a couple other questions here. So big screens versus small screens. You know, if you're going to go for a GTN 650 or a 750, they're practically the same thing with the same capabilities, more or less. 750's got a bigger screen. What value is that big screen when you've got, you know, an iPad in front of you with all the screen real estate that you could want?
So, okay, I ended up putting in the 650 XI, and I actually regret it. It's interesting. Of all the upgrades I've made over the years, I've never regretted spending too much. In that case, I regretted not going for the 750. I mean, it's not huge. I might change it someday down the road, but the ability to see more of your flight plan in one fell swoop. And also, there are a couple capabilities that the 750 has over the 650. I don't use it to see an approach plate, which you can do on the 750. That's what I have my iPad in the panel for. But, you know, it's not a huge game changer, but I actually do regret not putting in the 750.
Kevin.
I was in a similar situation, and actually still am ongoing in a similar situation as the scenario. And as far as the avionics upgrade goes, when we're talking about the screen size of the primary navigator, we, decades ago, got a Garmin 430, and that's what we had for a very long time. Now, at the time, the 530 had just come out, and it was, do we go with the 430 or the 530? And everybody thought, well, the 430 is cheaper, and it does all basically the same things, whatever, let's just go with the 430. So that's what the decision was made. And that's what we lived with for decades. In hindsight, basically everybody agreed that, boy, that would have been cool if we got the 530 instead of the 430. So when it came time to do our ADS-B upgrade and we were going to upgrade to a WASP GPS, we went with the 750. And I think pretty much everybody's been happy that we did.
So you'll never be unhappy spending more.
As long as you can pay for it.
John. You know, in a similar vein, I have a Dynan primary flight display in my RV4, and it came with the panel had a 7-inch hole in it. When I put the HDX in, I replaced it with another 7-inch one. Like Catherine, I wish I'd gone bigger. You know, it's like a 10-inch screen would have been really nice, and so if I had a do-over, I would go with the larger screen for the PFD. And it's not just for GPSs.
Yeah, but Bruce, you've got a lot of screens. You've got the G500, right?
G500 TXI.
TXI, yep. A GTN 750.
XI.
XI.
And my iPad.
iPad, yep.
Yeah. Yeah, but I've really come to like having, like on my 750, when I'm flying procedures like an approach, I use that like an FMS. It's showing my flight plan with all the fixes so I can easily keep track of where I am or manipulate the flight plan if I need to. I got the approach chart on my iPad. I've got a moving map, you know, on my PFD. So I've got plenty of information, and you have a little more flexibility with the 750 than you would. My experience with the 650 is it's a little too small for really looking at your flight plan or some other information. So yeah, I think larger screens are generally the better option. If you can make it work.
John.
I agree with all of this. The only footnote I would add is if you're going to do a full PFD or MFD, that's when you can get away with a smaller one. It doesn't look like that's what this club's going to do. They're going to do G5s. But if you think you're going to do a G500 TXI or a G3X Touch or something like that, in which case you're going to be using a big 7 or 10-inch screen as your moving map, in that case, it can make sense to use a 650 and save a little bit of money in real estate because you're mostly going to use that as data entry to drive the larger screen. I think if you're not going to do that and this is going to be your primary screen, that 750, that larger screen really does pay off.
Dave.
You know, if we're really going big here, I would just say, there's the screen size issue, but another really important factor is the integration and the cross-fill capability. Because when you have multiple boxes that don't talk to each other, that increases workload. It doesn't decrease it. As I'm hearing my fellow panelists talk about how they use the equipment, it's really helpful if that equipment can communicate with the other boxes in the panel.
Yeah, that's a really good point. The club plane that I've been flying lately has a 750XI, an Aspen, and a Century Autopilot, and they work together okay, but not perfectly, you know. And that's probably not by accident that the Garmin stuff plays nicest with other Garmin stuff. Catherine.
Yeah, to John's point, I do console myself with the 10-inch G3X Touch in front of me. And to your point, Dave, about having these boxes communicate with each other, you know, my panel is full of GPSs and devices. And it really hit me when I was flying a year ago down to the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I hadn't put in an arrival. They gave me an arrival. And I don't have the flight stream, so they don't necessarily cross-fill. So I was at a situation where, okay, I put it in heading mode, I put my arrival in, and then just as I have everything synced up, I get a direct destination. So I had to put it back in, you know, take it all back out. But absolutely. So I'm actually ordering that up, and it should be installed in a couple weeks.
Yeah, we're talking about a lot of touchscreens here, and there are a lot of people out there who will say, you know, quote, I don't like touchscreens, and people who would want to stick with the 530 just for that reason. Catherine.
Yeah, I'll say this for the Garmin touchscreens is you often have options to use a knob instead. So if it's really bumpy, you can console yourself with using a knob.
Yeah, the other trick, which many people learn when it gets installed, there are the little finger rests on the side and bottom, and that seems silly, but if you learn how to use that correctly, it makes a huge difference. You can brace your thumb and your pinky finger on the outside and use, you know, one of your middle fingers to tap. It seems silly, but you can do a lot on a touchscreen in turbulence if you're bracing your hand instead of sort of wildly waving it around. So,
Frank.
Yeah, I've got a pair of GTNXIs, and yes, you can do anything that you want to with the Navigator, and in fact, for that matter, with the G500 TXI, with knobs and buttons, physical controls that you would do with a touchscreen. However, the reality is, unless you're in moderate or worse turbulence, you are using the touchscreens. And in my case, I have no clue how to do it with the buttons and knobs.
See, I'm a button and knob guy, and I even use the button and knobs when it's smooth because I'm practicing for when it's bumpy. You know, I like that tactile interface, but I recognize I'm in a small minority there, and I've got nothing against my fellow pilots who use the screen and, you know, brace their hand or do whatever else they need to do to use those interface. And also another side effect and a side benefit from the touchscreens is that there are fewer data entry errors because, you know, it'll preload and you can just switch. If you know where to look for it, you can preload and switch radio frequencies, for example. And I noticed that especially when I'm tired, you know, there's just fewer data entry errors when you use the screens that way.
The only fine point I'd say is I'm committed on the touchscreen, and there's a setting in the GTNXIs now where you can use the knobs only for the radio, and that's what I use, is the knobs for me are radios because I'm old school that way, and so I will crank those to tuner frequency, and everything else on the screen is touchscreen.
Catherine.
Yeah, speaking of old school, you know, I'm really a steam gauge kind of gal as well, and those smart programmers at Garmin lets you dig into the system and actually put a six-pack up there. So I have an enormous attitude indicator, but it actually has a six-pack, which I love, because I don't need to know that it's, you know, 151 knots. I just need to know that it's, say, low 150s or somewhere around there. So I really appreciate the modernization of the big PFD, but a throwback to some of the dials, which I more easily read.
Yeah, so we went from talking about this basic steam gauge Warrior to, or Arrow rather, to, you know, now we're talking about dual GTN XIs and big PFDs and Garmin autopilots and everything. And I think the two main takeaways that I'm getting from this is, number one, vacuum systems used to be a necessary evil. Now they're just evil. Get them out of there as soon as possible. And number two, the plan is to eventually have everything.